This is John McEwen with SyndicatedNews.net, and I'm sitting today with Ray Benson for the Americana Music Show. Some of you may not know who Ray Benson is, so I'm going to ask him. Ray, if you ran into somebody in the airport and they said, "You're a musician, it looks like," what would you tell them?
I'd say, yeah, it was, it was that wrong turn at age 16. You know? Yeah, I play guitar and sing lead in a Western swing band. They'll go, "What's that?" Well, we play Western swing, which is music of Bob Wills. And if that didn't impress them, I'd say, "Well, I own studios, recording studios." Oh, wow.
Well, some of the people that will listen to this will know who Ray Benson and the Sleep at the Wheel is. They may not know what the first date was. What was that? When did you go calling it a Sleep at the Wheel, and here we go? What year?
1970. And Lucky Oceans, who I started the band with, we were living in West Virginia. And we had gotten permission to live on this farm and help our friends with the farm we worked. And so he was in an outhouse, actually, and came bursting out of the outhouse and said, "Let's call the band Asleep at the Wheel." And that's how it came about. So that was 1970. Me, Leroy, and Lucky started the band. We didn't have any gigs. We weren't very good, you know, but we practiced every day. And that's the origins of Sleep at the Wheel.
Did you all have the same type of music in your background? Because, like, when the Dirt Band started, we came from, like, three different areas: folk music, bluegrassy, and blues.
No. Well, Lucky and I grew up together, and we had tried every one of those. So we played all of them. Leroy was in rock bands and whatnot, pretty much, yeah. But what we wanted to do was pretty similar to what I think y'all wanted to do, was to discover reinvent and discover roots music, whatever that was to all of us at the time. That meant country blues, finger picking, bluegrass, honky tonk, anything that wasn't on the radio. And we also had one very particularly weird thing for all this, in that we wanted to have straight top 40 country western hit records. And we were long-haired hippies, counterculture at the time, you know, what you call, long-haired, and we were against the war in Vietnam. And if you were a country western artist, you were for the war in Vietnam. And so, but that was our goal.
You and Earl Scruggs in that regard.
They
went to the march,
exactly,
against the war.
Yeah. No, there were obviously
Skeeter Davis.
Exactly. There were those who understood that, but you know what I'm saying. If you wanted to make records. So anyway, we had hair down to here, and then we all cut our hair, because it was a dual kind of thing. The roots music stuff was what our musical life would be, you know. But we had this goal, and we attained it by having hit records in 1970, 4 and 5, on country western hit records, and went out on the road with a 10-piece band that was playing, you know, Bob Wills music, Moon Mulligan.
Now, Bob Wills, for those that don't know, is the guy that created Western Swing. Some people say he put the drums in country music.
That's correct.
Was disgusted many people in country music.
For many years.
Yeah.
And had horn players. And like you say, he was playing dance music. So he took the traditional fiddle music that he grew up with, which was Texas fiddling, and combined it with, like, Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller and that kind of stuff. Because what changed that was our first successful single, although it was not a huge hit. It was just the first one that got played, was Take Me Back to Tulsa off our first record.
Yeah.
So people, and what happened, John, was this incredible interest in Bob Wills centered on us, because Bob Wills was the Elvis Presley of his time. I mean, he had not just the music, you know, he happened to have incredible music, but to the general public, it was his charisma. He hollered and screamed and danced like a peacock, you know, and so
he was an entertainer.
That's when we got, when the record came out, this incredible interest. So anyway, we still pursued our record, and I had a top 10 record on The Letter That Johnny Walker Read. But we were out playing with, like, Donna Fargo and Tammy Wynette, and we had this 10-piece swing band, you know, with extended solos, and so it was kind of weird.
At what age were you in the 70s?
19.
So at what age were you when you kind of went, "I want to be on stage"? Was there a moment?
I was born on stage. It was, we had a group when I was 9 years old, my sister.
Who's we?
My sister, myself, and two neighbors called the 4 G's.
Mm-hmm. Four G's. Why that?
The parents picked the name. It was Guys, Gals, and Guitars.
Oh.
Then I joined the band in 1960. I got a guitar and taught myself some stuff, and then George Britton, this guy, they took folk music lessons, and we sang This Land Is Your Land, we sang Kingston Trio, we sang Charlie on the MTA. You certainly know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I was in one of those groups that had...
So when I joined the band, you'll love it, because it was Guys, Gals, and Guitars, and then I joined the band, and it was... And we had Goya guitars. Those Guys, Gals, and Goya guitars.
Oh.
So it was like gut string. But anyway, I was always on stage, and I was a ham, and I needed to. I played athletics, so I was a good basketball player and track and tennis. And so, but I played. And then in high school, or junior high, I took up the bass fiddle because exactly what you just said. Gosh, if we could add another instrument, what would it be? Well, a bass, because the guy in the Limelighters had a bass.
Yeah, that's a good reason.
So
Ray says, you say you were athletic. For those that don't know Ray Benson, you can go to asleepatthewheel.com and see some of the history of this fantastic group that I first ran into, I believe it was 1970. And he says athletic. Well, anybody familiar with Mutt and Jeff? Well, if you're standing next to Ray, most people are Mutt. if that's the short one.
I used to be 6'7", and you're no slouch. I mean, McEwen's 6'4", right?
Yeah.
I was 6'7", but I'm 6'6" now. That's how old I am. But anyway, you know, yeah, I played sports. You know, I love sports. But then I took up the tuba because they gave me. And back then in school, they'd give you the instrument. That's how I got the bass fiddle.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, bass fiddles were expensive. My parents were going to buy one, so they gave me one. I played in the orchestra, played in the swing band, and that's where I caught the Count Basie fever. I had a band director who gave me these Count Basie records. And went.
So by the middle 70s, Asleep at the Wheel kind of headed more towards Western swing.
Well, we had this big country Western hit, The Letter Johnny Walker Read, yeah. The top 10 record, and yeah, we were veering off into the strata, and we were doing Cajun music. And roots music. It's exactly what we wanted to do. Everything from Buck Owens to Bob Wills.
When did you meet Bob Wills?
Well, that's a funny story. In 1973, after we had made a record, Tommy Alsop got a deal in Dan Burgoyne's with United Artists, and they said, we can get Merle Haggard, who was the number one country singer, to sing on this record. So they signed Bob Wills.
How do you spell Alsop?
A-L-L-U-S-U-P. He was Buddy Holly's lead guitar player, mm-hmm. The second lead guitar player. And he was a Western swing, and he produced our first album. Anyway, he got the deal, and so they took Bob down to Dallas. Now, Bob was really sick. He,
mm-hmm.
he was young. He was 68, but he was had his heart attack and a stroke. And so he's there, and they asked us to come. We walk in the studio. He's in a wheelchair, and they introduce us, and they said, look, Mr. Wills is tired. We're going to take him back to his room. They take him back to his room. And we could talk to him the next day. Well, that night he had a stroke and he went to a coma, died 2 years later.
Oh,
so I met him, but we never got to talk to him.
Oh.
But Leon McAuliffe was there, Eldon Chamblin, all the band guys that were still around, Sleepy Johnson. We did an Austin City Limits with the Texas Playboys, which was the first Austin City Limits, actually. And got to meet all the old guys, and that's how we really learned the craft.
And for those that don't know, he's referring to the Texas Playboys, which was what Bob Wills called his band. And he became, well, he was the Elvis of Texas and the Midwest and Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Bob Wills was a movie star, a record maker. Take Me Back to Tulsa was one of his songs, as well as San Antonio Rose.
And San Antonio Rose was a million-seller record for Bing Crosby. So
mm-hmm.
It was a crossover record. And it's interesting, Hank Thompson one time told me, he's another great Western swing artist, and Hank said, if you've listened to, it's the new San Antonio Rose, because San Antonio Rose is just a fiddle tune.
Mm-hmm.
The Irving Berlin Music Company said, put words of that and take those fiddles off and put trumpets on. And that's how they made the new San Antonio Rose, which was a million-seller record.
So who was first? Bing Crosby's one with words and then Tommy Duncan?
No, they were the words version was simultaneous. You know how they did it back then. You know, a country artist would cut it, a pop artist, an R&B
mm-hmm.
artist, you know. And so that's how that went down. But the fiddle version was in 1930-something.
38, I think.
Yeah, something in the late 30s, and it wasn't until 45 or something. Yeah, Gimbel told me, Johnny Gimbel, the great fiddler who played in the band in the late 40s and early 50s, told me that they sent down words from the Irving Berlin Music Company, and they were real formal, and Bob said no, and and he gave one of the band members $5 and a jug of whiskey to write the words, and he did this. And, you know, that's how it was back then.
It's always difficult to put words together to describe a sound or a color. But if you're going to describe Western swing and how it moves you to somebody, what is it? Why?
It's the foot tapping music. It's, now you can say that about a lot of music, right? It's dance music, but it's swing music with strings. You know,
isn't the message usually kind of lighthearted?
Totally. There's no, although there's blues in it too. Song like Misery, you know, went to bed last night, wasn't sleepy. You know, it's all about being miserable.
Yeah.
But well, you know the deal. The idea is you sing about blues and it makes you feel better, so you may as well.
What is the most important recording in your? Now, how long of a history is it? 40 years?
Well, yeah, Dirt Band, which is like 49 or 100 years, we're not sure exactly when the band started, but you're 45 years
old. Well, right? You have more Grammys than Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah,
and I'm here as a person that wants to find out about you or let people that don't know about you. 14 Grammys?
No, 9 Grammys.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We may never win another
14 nominations.
Oh, I don't know. We lost track of the nominations.
Yeah, but see, the
but
good
you
thing
know why?
A nomination is as good as a
win. Oh, hell yeah. You get to go to the party, and you don't have to explain to the people who lost how much better they are than you.
And what other kinds of awards do you feel?
You know, I actually, and because you and I, McEwen and I are very much alike in that we are multifaceted. In other words, we do a lot of different things. And I won a regional Emmy for a film that I co-produce and helped do, which is a making-of film. You know, you've done them. But that's another interest, because before I started the band, I was going to be a filmmaker, and I apprenticed as an editor with Eli Landau, the great...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the pawnbroker, Long Day's Journey in the Night, and realized that I did not have the patience to sit in a dark room for
hours. Was Bob Wills a businessman?
No, the worst. His manager, O.W. Mayo, was. But Bob Wills was... Yeah, he was.
Who
terrible.
Did you look up to? Was he a lesson to you how to not do business?
Absolutely. And Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson is my best friend, who I love dearly, who has done more for me than anybody. But, you know, the way he handled business, the way he wanted to handle business. And that's the other thing he taught me was don't let the business make you unhappy. So whatever it is, it's. But his other advice was. Billy said, if there's a right way to do things, I'll try the wrong way first. Which has a lot of merit, not all the time.
There's a lot of great artists that are good businessmen. I mean, some people don't know that Mick Jagger was a finance major in college.
Really?
And people like Dolly Parton knew exactly what she was going to do.
You know,
I remember her telling me years ago when I asked her what her future held for her, she goes, well, I'm going to... make my own line of makeup because it costs a lot of money to look this cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to have an amusement park and call it Dollywood. Isn't that cute? And Dollywood's one of the major music amusement parks in the country.
Yeah.
And that's something I've always admired about you, Ray, is that you didn't just have a band. You, some might say, milk it for everything it's got.
You got to. You know,
you have your own restaurant in the Austin airport.
It's a hot dog stand in it.
It's a big restaurant.
But it's got, I have a club. You got to do that. You know, when you realize.
What do you have? You have the restaurant and the club.
A small club that I'm just, you know, it's my name and I put music in
it. And where is it?
In Austin, Texas, on 6th and Oasis. And I got 2 recording studios. And we have a management company because I was able to do it. But my business partner, which this, I bet you don't even know. My business partner's name is Peter Schwartz. And he was a. He was an MBA, and he went to Harvard, and he played music with Steve Riley and the Mambo Playboys, but his dad was Tracy Schwartz. And
I know who you mean, yeah.
So Peter's my business partner, and he's very organized, but he's been with me 11 years. John, you know, the only thing I knew was this is the music business, and I love the music, and, you know, as you know, more than, that's why we're here. But the business part of it is the reason we get to play music.
What is a moment on stage that you remember the most? I have a few. Is there one for you?
Well, no, hundreds. Being Willie Nelson's band, which we have been numerous times, when that is a out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
In every way. And I'll tell you one that really kind of surprised me was when we played the Grand Ole Opry for the first time, because they had turned us down for 20 years because we had a saxophone in the band. So when we finally got us on, it was because I love the Grand Ole Opry. You know, just I'd gone.
Now, did
there.
Bob Wills play the Opry?
Yeah, and they told him he couldn't use his drums, and he said, "Back him up, boys. We're going back to Texas." But he had a million seller record. He said, "Oh no, no, Mr. Wills, we'll put it behind the curtain." And that was the story, you know, the back curtain.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. He put it on stage because you couldn't play this music without drums.
Right.
So, you know, it felt kind of good because it was repeating history. And, you know.
Do you feel like you've made your own history, Ray?
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah. You know, the Dirt Band, Asleep at the Wheel, I mean, that's it. I mean, of those bands, the Brito Brothers, the Commander Cody, all the bands like ours that started in the similar ways in different places with different slants, but pretty much the same.
I always felt like a lot of the groups, like Brio Brothers, weren't really groups. They just came together because they were in between something else.
Must have been.
They were there for 3 years and quit.
Yeah, and like you say, and of course, you know, your band, you can never have Stones, anybody, the Rolling Stones, totally consistent, five guys the whole time. NRBQ's the same way. You've been in and out of your band. I've been here, but we've had people in and out of the band and 100 players in the band. It's a concept that goes back to the days of the big bands.
So you created a group that has turned into what you were emulating. Do you ever think of that? What you were emulating?
Every day, you know.
It's like Riders in the Sky are now, Riders in the Sky.
Because you, of course, knew Doug when he was an academic, and all of a sudden
I knew him Ranger Doug, when he was working in Grooving Guitars.
Yeah.
To what do you attribute, you know, like I said earlier, the 9 Grammys and success and a following that people know the name, even if they can't pin something exactly to it. But that's a good brand, that if you know the name, it's like a food you've heard of, but you just haven't tried it yet. And I always recommend people try Asleep at the Wheel. Make sure you go see them. Something interesting, I was interviewing Steve Vai last month, and he called himself a rock and roll entertainer. Steve Vai.
He's doing these pyrotechnics, and when he and you and I both know that it's, you know, it's really, give me one note that's better than anybody else, but show me that you can also play 100 of them. But, you know, he's doing, a friend of mine promoted a Jimi Hendrix show in 1968 or something, and you know, Jimmy had got tired of setting the guitar on fire and, you know, doing all the tricks, playing with his teeth, ha ha ha, you know, you stick to guitar, he's playing with his fingers, and he was doing all that because he's making money, and he turns to my friend on the side while he's going, blah, 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 and he goes, hell of a way to make a living, you know.
It's like one time I was talking to Ramblin' Jack Elliott, he's just talking like a normal person backstage.
No.
And somebody said, Jack, you're on in 10 minutes. He goes, oh, I better get into my act. And he actually turned into Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Yeah.
He was just a guy for a few minutes.
I love it. Just saw him the other day. He's 80, I think.
Oh, yeah. That sounds about right. Ramblin' Jack Elliott, where Steve Martin got the Ramblin' Guy idea.
Is that right? Oh, it makes sense. And of course, he was like, you know, what did a friend of mine say?
You know, Ray, is there a favorite type of venue? Do you like outdoors, indoors? Is there anything
What I'd love to play, yeah. Very simple, ballrooms. And there are very few where you have a big seated area and a dance floor.
You play the surf ballroom?
Of course, yeah.
That's
perfect.
And the surf ballroom is?
Where Buddy Holly died in Mason City. No, Mason City. What's the town?
Iowa.
Yeah, but the town it's in is next to Mason City, which is... look it up on the internet. You all got computers if you're listening to this. Wichita, Kansas, the Cotillion, you played there, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the ones. You know, that's what we like. But, of course, you know, we also do, I love listening clubs where they don't dance because they're listening. So, you know, those are the two extremes.
Have you ever had a time when you're doing this, you're getting some recognition, you're playing with Willie Nelson, all this stuff, are those times on the road where you go, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? I've done this enough. It's time to...
I never get that on stage. I get that on the bus. You know, where you're
going. How many dates a year is that?
About 120.
Now, there's 120 shows?
Shows, yeah.
So that's 160 days on the bus.
Yeah. You know, that's work. I mean, that is work. On the other hand, it's gotten better. I got your computer. We got traveling internet, satellite TV, cell phones. Before, you know, you'd go and you were gone. Yeah. Find a payphone. Physically, it's getting hard. You know, when you're over 60, it's the physical stuff is all that you worry about. My voice has been wonderful because I'm not a tenor.
How's your playing?
And my playing gets better. You and I are going to practice and play every day.
Do you do that?
Well, of course, because.
Well, some people might not know that.
I know. Yeah. Thank you. No.
Show days, I usually play at least 2 hours a day.
You're much better than me, but at home I do it more than on the road because when I'm playing it. And I write. I'm a songwriter.
I play about 8 notes a week at home.
That's funny. Yeah, that's where I do my. My kids are grown, et cetera. And
people, how many?
2 boys. One runs our studios and a very good engineer producer, and the other's in L.A. He's a video editor, and they're all wound up in show business, but. They don't like to perform. They don't want to go on stage, which is kind of funny.
Well, we're talking with Ray Benson on syndicatednews.net, the Americana Music Show, and he's had a 40-year career in professional music business. And as you said earlier, at around 9 years old, you kind of went, I want to be on stage. And although a lot of people listening may not know you, we hope you check them out. At what website can you find them?
SleepAtTheWheel.com, one word, or RayBenson.com. They're both there. And
B-E-N-S-O-N.
And we also have my television show, which is the Texas music scene featuring Ray Benson. And just go to YouTube. We post all of our shows. We're in 18 cities, and it's the young Texas singer-songwriters, rock and roll, country guys. It's great. It's really neat.
Yeah, you can always tell a Texan, but you can't tell them
much.
Yeah. Okay, so one thing we try to reach is people that are maybe getting interested in this business. You said you have a Young Texas. What's that about, the young musician thing?
Yeah, and that's why we have a club also. It's a 200-seat music club and a bar on top so that you can develop young artists, you know, young musicians.
Now, what are those 3 things you would say if you only – you're passing somebody in the airport and there's, give me some advice about the music business.
Which, as you know, happens daily. Play for yourself first, because there's a lot of rejection, and until you, unless you love what you're doing, the business and the music will beat you up. First thing, if they're players. Second thing is don't give up, and the third thing is have plan B, because you never know what's going to happen in this business, and that's I think part of what I've always done is I won't give up, but I'll have plan B. If you get to hit a wall that you know you're not going to be able to get over, that you know is futile, and that sometimes it's about talent. You have to be realistic about what am I good at, or what do people like when I get on stage. I like to play the guitar. You know, I get a hand here and there for playing guitar, but I'm a singer as far as the audience is concerned.
You're also a show producer.
Yeah,
you're the Bob Wills
band leader
of this time.
Yeah, yes, I do that well, and I can't do it without really talented people. And that's the other talent that I have, is that I can convince really good musicians to play this music, and it ain't, you don't get paid a whole lot.
Now, your band members, one's been with you 26 years?
Dave's the drummer, 26, Dave the bass player, 20, Jason the fiddle player's 16 years, I think, now, and he's played with you, remember, and when we went to England.
Oh, those guys were wonderful to me. We were doing a tour in England, 10 cities for the big country show, 15 acts.
Was it Waylon and
Johnny Cash and June Carter and Waylon, I believe. Yeah, and
Boxcar Willie.
Bill and Johnny Russell and people like that. And I needed some people to back me up.
Yeah, she said McEwing gets booked as a solo in a Wembley Arena.
Well, that was fine. I mean, I was also the MC, and that was fun.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. You know, the compere.
You know, we went over with that fellow who will remain nameless.
Mervyn Kahn.
He screwed us out of.
You know, I've known promoters like that. And sometimes they can, you know, Jim Clark was a bluegrass promoter. But if it hadn't been for him giving me a hot check, which I knew was a hot check, it would never. It's still bouncing. And that was 25 years ago. Yeah. But I ended up on stage with Mabel Carter. I should have paid him.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
what I told my business partner. I said, you know what? We played with the Reba McEntire and Ricky Skaggs in some wonderful halls, and people saw us who would have never seen us before. So
there's something that happens with show business for me with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. It seems to be a formula that the highest paying dates are often the least amount of fun.
Yeah.
Does that happen to you?
There's the correlation of the higher the ticket price, the less the applause. In our cases, you know, yeah, we're working bands. We have what we call niche followings, you and us both. We've have both had success on radio at times and different things, but that's not what keeps you out there. What keeps us out there is when you get on stage, people love what you do. And that's the ticket to sticking around.
So does that make the day? Do you have dark days? Do you have down days?
Hell yeah. You bet.
And what was some of the bad ones where you had a show to do, and what happened?
Oh, where I'm sick, you know, and you gotta go on stage. The show must go on, you know. I always have done that. You know, get on stage with a fever, you know, get on stage, you know. That sucks because it doesn't get better on stage. You know, just Lord, let me make it through this one. That's all. And,
what about personal life issues?
Yeah, divorce, you know, that kind of thing, you know. I've only been married once and divorced once only, but you miss the things that everybody else gets. On the other hand, I signed up for it, so I never, you know, but that's what you got to deal with. It's
and does the audience, has it ever helped you get through it? That
hell
day?
Yeah. You know, it certainly makes it all right. And the thing you got to be careful of is the hills and the valleys, you know, it's just, they're going to be there. Show business is not an incline. It's a roller coaster if you're lucky enough. And like I said before, enjoy it for yourself, and everything else is a plus. You know, and people don't know if you're out of tune. People don't know if you're a virtuoso. People don't know if you're original. People know if you're having a good time. You know, that's all I've noticed on stage. And I want to have the highest level of musicianship I can get, but that ain't gonna that ain't going to make half the audience. Half the audience might know that if you have a very educated audience, you know. But the other half.
Speaking of the audiences, what was the worst situation?
The worst, well, it's simple, was in Tahoe. We got in trouble and we had to play Lake Tahoe, the lounges, you know.
Uh-huh.
No, we had to do 3 shows on the weekend, and the last show started at 2 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And the curtain goes up, and there's one guy in the front row, drunk and happy and going. And, you know, we got to play an hour show. By the end of the show, there were 4 people in there, you know. But, you know, I always say, well, you know, you and I like to play. You like to play. I like to jam. So just go, okay, ignore the audience tonight.
Paid rehearsal.
Paid rehearsal. And the folks who can't figure that out ain't going to last long. You know. And it's the other thing is that the people who understand that when you do have success, it ain't going to stay there. So figure out that part, you know. You know, try to make it stay there. Try to have number one records one after the other. Try to have the thing. But if it don't happen, it's still a good way to make a living and enjoy playing the music, you know.
What's the best place you've played?
Well, you know, you'd have to... Red Rocks.
Red Rocks is a park outside of Denver that holds 9,000 people.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful place.
I think we played with you, probably.
I hired you once, actually.
I think you're the only time we played, because Barry Bay would never hire us. Yeah. And has Chucky got it now?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's my best pal, but yeah. You think he'd hire us? No.
After Red Rocks, there was some...
They're just gorgeous, because Red Rocks is the most beautiful venue I've ever seen, I think. But I like the historic places. The first time I played Kane's Ballroom was real emotional.
Kane's Ballroom is a classic club in Tulsa that was mentioned earlier, where the Bob Wills birthday party, I believe, happens every year.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And, but it's where Bob played in the 30s, you know, and... I actually played there when we were backing up Country Singer. I played with a guy named Stoney Edwards in 1971. We played there. And literally, you'll love this. The mic was hanging. Hangs down on the thing. One mic, you know, one of them old.
Like a boxing ring mic.
Sure, right.
Yeah.
And in the, you open the thing on the side, and there was a Bogan amp. And on the speakers were those big round circular.
Yeah.
You know, like the rodeo
type of thing. Yeah.
And we pull in, and we had a Colin PA, you know. And I said, well, I reckon we're going to set up this. And the old lady said, well, that was good enough for Bob Wills. I don't see why y'all can't use it. I love it, because I love that Ernest Tubb had a Live at Kane's record that we all learned how to play on. When you're young, those moments or something, or when that first red light went on, the first record, you and I were both on United Artists Records, mm-hmm. you know, and I think y'all were really the reason we got the deal.
I do understand that.
Yeah, because they had this weird band called Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I don't know, you know, and Dan Burgoyne was there, and so y'all, they were shipping that triple record, and you know, nobody in Nashville had sold 100,000 records, and this was, and I remember your brother piling them up in the United Artists office in Nashville. You know, he had to bring them up. Hey, listen, you guys are going to send these to your radio stations, by the way. Anyway, and, you know, it was just amazing how they said, get me another Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. What's that about? Kids with long hair playing country-like music with a funny name. I swear, you know, that's probably what went on in the A&R meeting, you know.
I was curious about something. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Ray Benson and Sleep at the Wheel and his dream idea of a group to be on the road happens to be one that he lives. And I've known many of the guys that play with you a lot, for years. And they're all very dedicated. And, yeah, you've gotten 9 Grammys and other accolades and stuff. But I've always felt like that's what you're supposed to get when you work in the business.
Yeah.
You're supposed to get, if you're a plumber, you want to get the Plumber of the Month award. And you're not supposed to be ignored or have the most mediocre. And those are proud moments, for sure. Like, oh, hey, but
yeah,
it's better for the relatives than maybe
yeah,
for you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've worked really hard. And you did something, and by whatever reason, you got the Grammy. Like, I was nominated the same year you were in the 90s, and you beat me.
Really?
With Red Wing.
Because we loaded up everybody.
You had a version of Red Wing with half the people in Texas.
Yeah, with Chet Atkins and Marty Stewart in Nashville. Hell, it was everybody there was, you know.
That was wonderful.
Elton, and it was the only time Elton ever got a Grammy.
And I went, I don't have a chance.
Then,
my point of this is, that is a good thing, and it's a fun game to play.
Yeah.
But there are prouder moments that happen on the professional level. You've been doing this maybe 20, 25 years into it, and you went, man, this was a cool thing. And it's not an award or anything.
Well, it was. It was after being without a record deal for 4 or 5 years, getting a record deal.
Hmm.
Going, we're back in. And
what year was that?
86.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, and we're back on the radio. You know, they weren't huge hits, but they were top 20 Billboard top 20 hits, you know, on House of Blue Lights and stuff that shouldn't have been, you know. So that was really, because when you ask about that, the dark day, 1985, you know, and I got a kid and another on the way, and I'm making $18,000 a year, you know, and the band's in debt, and, you know, that old buzz is broken, and I'm thinking, I'll have to get a job. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try. But every day that, you know, a $2,500 gig would come in or something, we'd somehow get there. And so when I send this demo and CBS Records says, yeah, we want to sign you back, you know, that he was like, oh, back, we're back. We're going to actually get another chance, you know. And part of it was, and it wasn't like I said, and part of it was, you know, I quit doing cocaine in 82, and that helped.
I bet.
I wasn't horrible like some of the people we all know, but I did abuse, and it was...
So that helped.
That helped.
But getting the record deal... You know when John Lennon got his record deal in the 70s? He goes, I better make an album. And he got a $10,000 advance, and it helped turn...
People don't realize that.
It's just amazing.
And how screwy, of course, that part, you know, recouping a $10,000 advance. Do you realize that our United Artists record is still unrecouped?
That's funny.
It's unbelievable.
And what people don't realize he means by that is when you're an artist with a normal record deal, they'll advance you some money to make your album and to live while you're making it. You can't really go on the road to make an effective album. And you might be off the road for 5 months or more. And if the record starts selling, they take the money out of your royalties for what you spent.
Yeah, and of course add other costs.
And if you were supposed to get $1.50 royalty on a record, which in the days of LPs would be considered a high royalty.
No, well, not even close.
It's a high royalty, right?
Well, back then, wholesale was $3.99.
Well, I'm saying I'm thinking more like 80s.
Same 1972, though. We were get like 60 cents, and it keeps diminishing over the years.
Now, what happens is they would deduct 10% for packaging, 10% for broken records, which they still deduct on CD deals, and they don't break. And then they deduct, then there's a thing called reserves. So you sell 500,000 records, and your statement comes in and says you've sold 80,000.
Yeah.
And they're paying you on only,
and you don't get paid
60%
until you sue them. So anyway, that's just part of the deal, you know.
And yet you wanted another record deal, and it made your day.
Yep. Well, that's how you did it, you know.
Yeah.
Like nobody else was. I remember Willie telling me that he had, when he had sold, you know, Nightlife and Funny How Time Slips Away and Crazy for $100. And I said, how could you have done that? He said, I never made 1 cent writing songs. Somebody offered me $100 that paid the rent. Here comes Jason.
Well, Ray Benson.
We better get dressed, yeah.
Ray Benson was asleep at the wheel we've been visiting with on the Americana Music Show. And is there anything you would like to leave people with that might be listening?
Drink a lot of water, stay off your feet, and come when you can, friends.
To an Asleep at the Wheel show. They're still out there. Thank you.
Honey, the dark man picks the cotton, but the white man gets the money. Take